This week on Future Tense, it's time to don a mask and a cape and explore your inner superhero.
I guess being a superhero isn't really about being good at everything. It's about finding that one thing that you're very good at and pulling it out when you need to, and that helps you get through the day and the challenge that you have. And I figure everyone wants to be a superhero, particularly young people, and we all have a superhero in us. And I figured if we're getting young girls dressing up as superheroes, why not get them dressing up as tech superheroes and trying to get the message that they can literally create their own future?
It's called the Tech Girls Movement, an innovative approach to get young girls not just to embrace, but to create technology. And that was the superhero Juella, also known as Dr. Janine Beekhuizen. We'll hear more from her later. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. And we'll also talk with University of New South Wales art and design lecturer Catherine Moline, who's been running some interesting workshops around humans and their digital masters. They're smartphones. That's to come. But first, a follow-on of sorts from our program last week on the use of virtual reality for the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder. Our first guest today is a fellow named Brett Levy, and he also has a fascination with using virtual worlds for a higher social purpose.
Your journey begins on the southernmost meander of the Brisbane River. Starting in an old and tall gum forest, its trees grow right to the river's edge. Fulfill the tasks, follow the role and responsibilities of a traditional custodian.
Virtual Songlines is the knowledge, the culture, the arts, the language, the law and customs of Indigenous people. Basically, that's actually the definition of songlines. Virtual Songlines is a recreation of that using new media technologies, computer technologies.
Since 1997, Brett has been working on perfecting what's now become his virtual songline software. It's an immersive audio-visual environment that shows the viewer an image of Australia prior to European settlement. With a smile, Brett calls himself a time traveller. Now, the central idea of virtual songlines is to use modern virtual reality technology not just to illustrate the past, but to recreate it. And the representation he presents is one that mimics an online game, where a player is given the avatar of an Indigenous Australian and is then able to move that avatar through a virtual space that replicates the Australia of the past. And at various points along the journey, a player is then given tasks to do, like hunting a kangaroo or gathering firewood, for example. But the most impressive thing about virtual songlines is its historic, topographic and cultural detail.
Follow the northern path, it'll take you to a place we call Kurilpa. It's a pocket of rainforest palms, staghorns, alcorns, orchids, creepers and dangling vines. You'll visit it later, you'll be asked to go there to collect things like twine, fibre, bark, eggs, native plums, seeds.
How accurate is the information that the player has when they're using their avatar and they're moving through that space?
Well, we're trying to make it as authentic as possible, so as accurate as we possibly can make it with what we know of what it was like then. So if we've got any historical detail about soil maps, that gives us a chance to then place the vegetation exactly where we feel it was at the time. We know what from vegetation, transect vegetation studies, what various vegetation types were like, and then we can reproduce those into this space where they were. That's one part of it. Next, we know what the meanders of the rivers were and where the placement of those rivers were. We can replace those where they were filled in or taken over, including the swamps and the other locations. And then furthermore, we can then put the animals in as we know they would have been in those areas. Maybe now they're not here, but at the time they were frequenting all these spaces. For example, Kangaroo Point was called Kangaroo Point because there was a lot of kangaroos there when they first sailed up that river. And they were there for quite a while until such time as that place became farms supporting the early settlement.
And importantly, with what you've got here, with virtual songlines, the person playing the game not only gets an idea of what Australia, a part of Australia, would have looked like before European settlement, but it's very much location-based, isn't it? The part of Australia they experience is the part of Australia that they're standing in as they're playing the game.
That's it. That's exactly what I'd like to try to achieve. I'm trying to work with a lot of key cultural heritage organisations, cultural organisations, and if we can get an iteration of this at their spaces, then that's a very good start to respect the deep connection of Indigenous people to that place. I'll say it like this. Many times we go to an event and we see a welcome to country, respecting the past, the traditional owners of the past, the elders of the past and present, and then, of course, the meeting goes on. I think a better way would be to actually show people what it was like at that space, at that time, as it was, and that would showcase that deep connection, I think, far better than a few accolades.
What does this kind of approach give somebody? What sort of extra knowledge does it give them about Indigenous culture and also what the environment was like before European settlement in Australia that museums or books or other forms of media don't give them at the moment?
Well, I'd say it's simply being that most of the stuff you're seeing is passive. You're an observer. You're probably reading. You're watching an old image. You're sort of trying to picture what it's like to be there. It's like my old grandfather saying to me, when you want to go back to country, close your eyes and it'll take you there. And if you've been there, that's important. So what we're saying here is we know there's concrete covering cultural sites. This gives you a chance to actually see that, to be in it and to move through it and have it surrounding you, you know, front and back. It's just the next medium, I believe. I think interactive virtual environments is tantamount or comparable to a book, to a film, to an image. But we're just trying to bring this stuff to life.
As should be obvious, making a virtual environment that tries to, as accurately as possible, replicate the past terrain and vegetation of a specific geographic site is time-consuming indeed. Brett Levy has already managed to recreate a large section of Inner Sydney, which he calls Virtual Warani, and a large portion of Inner Brisbane, which he calls Virtual Meanjin. The idea from here is to get cultural institutions and organisations all across Australia to commission a virtual songlines experience for their own geographic area. One of those who's shown initial interest is the Brisbane City Council. Emily Murphy is the coordinator for a council program called Gathering, which seeks to provide a weekly public display of Indigenous art and culture in the city's busy pedestrian shopping mall.
For me, when I saw this, the Virtual Warani, which is the name for Sydney Harbour, so this was a prototype sort of 2 years ago, when he showed me that then, I was absolutely enamoured and got goosebumps around the idea of being able to step back in time and to be able to see the flora and the fauna and the sights of the area of Sydney, and now here, Meanjin, of the area of Brisbane City, as it was pre-white settlement, to be able to see the integrity around the campsites and the trails and the flora and the fauna and the animals that he's kind of created with his mapping through a whole mass of research and, quite frankly, an incredible injection of passion.
And what do you think people get out of it? I mean, it's interesting, it's very well put together. What do you think they take away from it?
For me, and from watching people who have interacted with the program, it is that kind of amazement of walking on country that is now bricks and mortar, but was then incredible scrubland or mangrove or, you know, whatever the topography was then. I have seen aunts and uncles, so elders, sit down and be able to navigate their way through country and them crying. And I guess the way that they have been able to interact with the program and get this sense of self and space and place, you know, it really is grounding. I've seen children be able to then sit with their grandparents and, you know, learn language around what these particular flora and fauna were or what these acts were and artifacts were, and that cultural sharing that is something that is very, very modern, but also translates to something that is very, very ancient.
Look, listen, and learn knowledge. Passed down from generation to generation since time immemorial. This latest iteration uses advanced computer software and hardware technologies to provide a more realistic, immersive heritage experience. However, in this type we have embedded digital...
I've shown this to thousands of Indigenous people to get their feedback. Family are chuffed as anything and saying they want to do our country. Non-Indigenous people see, you know, want to verify its truth and its information and I suppose deconstruct it. Indigenous people, I think, see a deeper connection and spirituality, and it triggers a lot of conversations. Everybody sees it differently. I want people to be there, really. I want to give them a chance to explore the historically accurate places and basically empathise with what it was like to be an Aboriginal person living in this space before there was any settlement encroaching upon that.
Brett Levy from the company Ochre Bilby and his Virtual Songlines Immersive Heritage Environment. I'm Anthony Fennell. This is Future Tense, new ideas, new approaches, new technologies. The edge of change.
Hi, I'm Kate.
And I'm Kaya.
And we're Team Supercape in the 2015 Search for the Next Tech Girl Superhero.
Not good at drawing? Well, Creative Drawer will help you.
With 12 step-by-step drawing lessons, you'll be an artist in no time.
We have created an app that teaches people how to draw.
The app is simple and easy to understand, so it's ideal for children or people with not much experience in drawing.
The app costs only $99.
Two of the very young schoolgirls whose interest in technology and science is being fostered by the Tech Girls Movement, an educational initiative created, as I mentioned earlier, by Brisbane-based academic, innovator and educator Janine Beekhuizen. Janine, welcome to Future Tense.
Thanks, Anthony. Nice to be here.
What is the Tech Girl Movement? Explain that to us and what its ambitions are.
So the Tech Girl Movement provides free resources to schoolgirls to help them build technology to create their own future.
And this is about, isn't it? This is about positive female technology roles, but it's also about greater diversity in the technology sector as well, isn't it? That's the underlying theme.
Absolutely. It's about empowering individuals, but to hopefully create a critical mass where we can change the culture of the technology industry, which at the moment has a very skewed view of diversity. We don't have enough women or minorities in general represented in the software that gets built, so we need to help individuals to take those roles on in the future.
Now, as I mentioned in the intro, you take a quirky and innovative approach to this problem of trying to get girls interested in technology. Just take us through the way in which you do it and why you do it in the way that you do.
Thank you. I appreciate that. There's been lots of efforts over many years to try to get more girls interested in STEM, as we call it, so science, tech, engineering and maths. And there's lots of great activities going on, but I find they're quite disparate and there's not a lot of connection and there's not a lot of longevity with them. So great activities here and there, but connecting them and having a longer term commitment to this. So therefore, I devised the Tech Girls Movement and the Tech Girls Are Superheroes campaign to present women who work in STEM as superhero characters. And I guess being a superhero isn't really about being good at everything. It's about finding that one thing that you're very good at and pulling it out when you need to, and that helps you get through the day and the challenge that you have. And I figure everyone wants to be a superhero, particularly young people, and we all have a superhero in us. And I figured if we're getting young girls dressing up as superheroes, why not get them dressing up as tech superheroes and trying to get the message that they can literally create their own future out there, and building hands-on skills into the program as well. So it's not just about inspiring young girls, it's about empowering them to actually build skills themselves so they have business skills, technology and social skills that they can actually take to make a big difference in the world.
So there's two levels to this, isn't there? There's an artistic level that these girls in schools around Australia are talking about technology, talking about superheroes and what sort of superhero they'd like to be. And then from that material, that information, you help them to create a cartoon superhero. That you put online and then you put in book form that goes out to schools. And then there's also the very practical side, as you said, where these girls are teaming up and they're developing technology, they're developing apps.
They absolutely are. So I'm running a competition called the Search for the Next Tech Girl Superhero. So we're in the second year now and we will be running it again in 2016. And essentially the girls work through a 12-week curriculum that has been built by a company in the US. And that 12-week curriculum gets them to think about an idea that for an app that will help them make their community a better place. Then they have to do some research around that app. They have to see if there's some competitors out there. They have to design a logo and how the app will work in terms of a wireframe step by step. Then once they've done that, they use App Inventor, which comes out of MIT, a free resource, and they essentially build a prototype of their app all in 12 weeks.
Obesity is on the rise in Australia, as one quarter of adolescents are obese. This number is quite shocking and may grow bigger unless something changes. However, there is a resolution. Introducing Barcoda, an app that tackles the rise of obesity throughout teens and young adults. Its job
So the pictures have come in very recently and they're absolutely amazing. These young girls and the ideas that they have. I mean, things like having a local community dog walking service so kids can get out and they can find people in their local community who need dog walkers, so the kids will go and actually find those people and connect online. And so some really amazing ideas.
And some of these apps have taken off, haven't they?
They really have. So the winner of the last year's competition is Sarah Price from Melbourne Grammar, and she created an app called Positive Penguins, and it helps young kids build resilience. At the time of the competition, she was 12 and she had sold 20,000 copies of her app. And this year, we have someone in the competition and she has got an app which you put in the dimensions of your body shape and it shows you what clothes would suit your body shape, which is a really amazing idea. And she's already been pitching that to a mobile payment company. So there's some amazing success stories of these girls just in 12 weeks' time. It's incredible.
Now, the Tech Girl movement's only been going for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And by looking online, and we'll link to your website on our website, it doesn't look like a lot of encouragement is needed. The girls involved seem to be really into it and really taking it on board.
Absolutely. It's incredible to see the excitement and how they are seeing themselves as superheroes and that they can actually make a difference with technology. They're taking it on. The pitch videos that you'll see, they're so excited. And we've had some really great teachers on board as well, which is key. So teachers who are encouraging the girls to get involved in the program and to helping them along the way with their app. Each team also gets matched with a mentor, so someone who works in the tech industry, and that mentor meets with them for 1 hour per week online. So the competition's purely online. There's no barriers in terms of where people are located. And it's been a really great process because they get to be mentored by people who work at Facebook and cool companies like that. And for an 8-year-old, how exciting.
The role of teachers, you said, is crucial. How have education authorities, though, responded to this as an idea?
Surprisingly well. I'm talking with some education bodies about how we can maybe roll this out into schools and have it as part of the curriculum in schools. I mean, the curriculum is built. It's there. It's freely available. So how can we adapt that into the classroom? And I've got a couple of schools very, very interested in doing that next year.
And you take a multimedia approach to this challenge, don't you? I mean, there is a printed book form. There's a website. You know, you can engage on Instagram or Twitter. I presume that's important if you want to have the greatest reach possible for a younger cohort.
It's absolutely key. The multiple messages across different mediums over time is the research that I've been engaged in for many years and that this work is built upon says we do need lots of messages in different ways to reach different audiences. And I find I have quite different audiences on, say, Facebook to Twitter to Instagram and with the hard copy book. And I want to sort of cover every possible base that I can. So, and at first I had a lot of questions around why would you do a hard copy book when particularly it's about technology and we're in a digital era. But it's something like 60% of teenage girls don't read ebooks. So, I mean, their audience isn't in that place where I need them to be. And for me, reading is so important. I loved reading growing up and I want girls to read. And a lot of kids don't read books these days. So I wanted to give them something fun to engage them in that process.
Now, we've done quite a bit on this program in the past on the need to get greater diversity in our science classrooms mm-hmm. and at universities. And there are a lot of people who are concerned about the low levels of girls taking on STEM subjects. What is it about the Tech Girl movement approach, do you think, that has been successful? What is it that's struck a chord with girls that perhaps some of these other approaches haven't?
I think it's having the freedom to create what you want and the creativity element. So people often throw around the acronym for STEAM, so the A in STEM and putting arts into it, which isn't a bad thing. I think technology is naturally creative, or STEM is naturally creative, but we don't associate it with that. So I think it's just making that really tangible, that creativity. And I mean, everyone uses mobile phones these days and apps are just in people's hands all the time. So the fact that young girls can have their own app on the App Store and have something really tangible that their friends can use, I think is really exciting.
Dr. Janine Beekhuizen from the Tech Girl Movement, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And as always, go to our website if you want more details about any of today's guests and the work they do. Our URL is abc.net.au/radionational/programs/future-tense. Or do it the way I prefer and simply type RN and future tense into your search engine. Our name on Twitter, by the way, is at RN Future Tense, all one word. Now, as Janine said, everyone uses mobile phones these days. And that statement provides the perfect segue into our final guest, Dr. Catherine Moline, from the Faculty of Art and Design at the University of New South Wales. Over the past year, Catherine has run several workshops entitled Myths of the Near Future, which has been all about exploring the relationship we have with those small rectangles of plastic and rare earth metals that we obsessively carry around with us wherever we go. Catherine Moline.
It started from a series of works I'd done with phones and then mobile phones, just observing that their behaviours were changing. And I do a lot of teaching with media and communication design and have taught a lot of stuff around this in different exercises. So the workshop brought together those exercises, if you like, in a different series, which I've run with senior researchers down at RMIT and first-year design students at Griffith.
And it's designed, isn't it? These workshops are designed to get people rethinking the assumptions that they have about their relationship with the smartphone technology.
Exactly. I mean, it comes from a very different angle than human-computer interface researchers or people involved with classic ethnography. It's really looking at trying to shock or defamiliarise people's assumptions about their phones and how they use them.
So how do you go about doing that?
Well, I set a couple of pre-workshop activities. One is to read a J.G. Ballard short story called The Intensive Care Unit from the 1970s, and another is to shadow or stalk a friend while they're using their mobile phone and to observe just the different interactions that happen. And the J.G. Ballard story is quite shocking. It really does predict webcams and talks about a family who meet for the very first time after their entire family life being conducted via webcam. And it was written in the 70s, and how they unfortunately all murdered each other when they first met. They were so shocked at what they were really like when they weren't curated via TV.
So the idea is this curation aspect, isn't it? That many of us don't realise that while smartphones are terrific things, they are actually curating our lives in a way that other forms of technology haven't in the past.
Exactly. And, you know, sort of wisely or acutely self-conscious when they're using their phones. So they've become kind of branding mechanisms, not often heartfelt, you know, raw gossip that you might have heard on the telephone previously. But when particularly when people use images, they're curating their own lives. So that really changes things.
So we think about communication devices as just that, as communication devices. We often don't realise, do we, that they are also part of storytelling, the storytelling of our own lives. How did you address that story-making aspect of mobile technology with the participants in these workshops?
Well, once we've sort of discussed the kinds of ideas that the short story and stalking a friend brought up for people, participants in the workshop, we then go into sharing gossip, really, about phones, things that have happened, mishaps, errors, overheard conversations they probably shouldn't have. Participants have lots of good stories about, you know, problems with phones. And also, you know, delightful media moments, I call them, where they have two things coinciding, listening to something on the radio or overhearing a piece of music from a distant location while they're driving their car or doing two things at once. Because I think, you know, the mobile phone and multitasking brings up lots of serendipitous moments. So we talk about that for a while. And then I ask them to, and by this point, they're usually very comfortable and had a few laughs. So we swap phones, or I invite participants to swap phones. Some people opt out at that point because they don't feel that, or they're aware that there's something on their phone they don't want someone else to see. But most people go along with it, and we just have a discussion about any areas that are no-go zones that they don't want other people to look at. And then I ask them to do what I call a spoken portrait of the, you know, semi-stranger whose phone they have in their hands. So it's got a great sort of, I guess, slightly voyeuristic aspect to it, but it kind of creates, I give them 20 minutes to create a spoken portrait or a description of the person from what's in their phone.
And the voyeuristic aspect, the stalking, as you said, of yeah. other people's uses of mobile phones, that's about seeing the phone not through your own eyes, but through the eyes of somebody else. Is that correct?
That's right. And I think this sort of brings up ideas. And of course, there's a lot of commentary going on around surveillance and how people are storing so much stuff on their phone that they're not even aware of. You just forget what kinds of photographs you've got, the sorts of texts that are still in your instant messaging or emails you've sent, your search histories in Google. All that stuff kind of is open for somebody else to go through and get to know you through your phone.
Now, you've told us about the specifics of the workshop and what you wanted to do. Just tell us about some of the reactions that you got from participants.
One participant, this was at RMIT, commented on her realisation of how little she remembered about what she stored on her phone. She said, in her words, "As the mobile phone is a thing that assembles a lot of activities in my life, that both serves as a tool for organising and for disorganising, I became a bit uncertain of my use of it. And to be quite frank, I had no idea of how little I knew of what kind of traces I have left on my phone." Another really strong comment was about the affective dimension of smartphones. And this participant commented that it renewed their attachment to the phone, saying that he left the workshop feeling a bit more affectionate towards my phone, or his phone, because it's not only the big data, what's collected about me through my use, but that as an object it can be revealing to another person. And I think that pretty much sums up the whole idea of how the workshop really looks closely or embraces uncertainty and a lot of ambiguity, because we don't think about these things necessarily consciously. We just kind of take them for granted. They're tacit understandings. And when the workshop pulls out what's really going on with people in their phones, it gives them some new ideas to take back to maybe thinking more about their phone use.
Well, Catherine Moline, thank you very much for joining us on Future Tense.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And Catherine's workshops have been... Hang on, let me just turn this thing off. Annoying little things, aren't they? There. As I was saying, Catherine's workshops have been held with RMIT University in Melbourne and in conjunction with the Experimental Thinking Design Practices exhibition that's just finishing up at the Queensland College of Art at Griffith University in Brisbane, and for which Catherine was a curator. Our other guests today were Janine Beekhuizen from the Tech Girls Movement, Emily Murphy from the Gathering Initiative, and Brett Levy, the creator of Virtual Songlines. Now, next week on Future Tense, something completely different, the aeronautical technology that could make the Concorde look like a kite.
Hypersonic, really, technically, is when you start flying so fast that you start to change the nature of the air you're flying through. The air goes through shock waves, it becomes heated with friction, it becomes so hot that the nature of the air changes, starts to chemically decompose. So the challenges are, how do you efficiently propel an aircraft, a vehicle, at hypersonic speed? And we're trying to do that with air-breathing propulsion called scramjets. How do you build it out of materials that can withstand the very high temperature environment? So these are the challenges. So you asked about the opportunities. Well, if we can have a means of propulsion to fly at very fast speeds, it leads to opportunities like flying anywhere in the world in a couple of hours. Maybe someday we'll be able to turn this technology into very fast-flying airplanes. Or, you know, the things we launch into space are on rockets. We fly them one time and we throw them away. That's a very expensive proposition. What if we could use this hypersonic technology to someday build a space plane? Takes off from a runway, accelerates to high hypersonic speed, and only turns on the rocket at the very end of its flight to get into space, and then comes home, lands, and we do it again. And the hope is that someday we can maybe reduce the cost of getting to low Earth orbit by a factor of 100. And that's the kind of promise and opportunity we would hope to achieve someday.
Dr. Kevin Bocut, the head of hypersonics research at Boeing, speaking to me there from California. And we'll also hear about the role Australia is playing in helping to perfect scramjet technology.
It's an active area of both scientific and sort of more applied activity. Here at the University of Queensland, we have a centre for hypersonics, and we have about 30 staff, four or five academics, and then a whole lot of PhD students and also some researchers. We're actually planning a subscale flight test in December of this year. And so we're in the process of manufacturing that vehicle right now.
Michael Smart from the University of Queensland, among our guests next week as we take a look at the potential of hypersonic flight. Thanks to my co-producer Karen Savanovitz and to audio engineer Steve Fieldhouse. This is Future Tense. I'm Anthony Fennell. Cheers.
On the moon. First dog on the moon.
Morning, Moneypenny. You've changed, Moneypenny. Is he in?
Good morning, WN. Have you brought the guide to modern living?
Here you are, sir.
First dog on the moon's guide to modern living. Stream or download it at the RN website.
Put them in the van.
Oh, not again! Stop it!